Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. This hour, it's a parent-teacher conference around kids in school coming back from a pandemic shutdown out of their COVID eclipse. What have we learned or failed to learn about education in this blighted year? Is it true that American classrooms will be more segregated by race, class, income, and effectiveness than they were a year ago or 10 years ago? What is the Joe Biden agenda? What is our assignment for the new president? Can a divided country agree ever again that public schools are the core social project, the American road to freedom, equality, middle-class mobility? We've got three angles of up-close experience in this conversation. Jennifer Berkshire is our journalist with a new book on the wolf at the schoolhouse door, she says. Noliwe Rooks is the W.E.B. Du Bois professor at Cornell. She covers a wide swath of race, gender, culture of all kinds. Her new book is titled Cutting School. Linda Nathan has done the impossible for decades. She's been a school builder and rule breaker inside the hidebound Boston public school system. We'll get to her book, too, called When Grit Isn't Enough. Bold strokes to start, please. Jennifer Berkshire first. You think public education is fighting for its life. How so?
I do think it's fighting for its life. I would go straight to a civics lesson, Christopher, and that is that I think a lot of people listening are aware that there's this bold push in a lot of states to suppress voting and to limit people's access to the polls. But what they may be a lot less aware of, often hand in hand with that effort in many of those very same states, is an effort to privatize public education. We've spent so much time fighting about things like charter schools. I'm talking about something far more audacious, and that's really the idea that you just give some portion of taxpayer dollars to the parents and you say, you decide what to do with it. You want to homeschool? Go do it. You want to pay for private school tuition? Go do it. And I think we've had such a wake-up call during this pandemic about what it looks like when our common bonds are frayed.
Jennifer, this sounds like Betsy DeVos, but she's out of office.
Absolutely. Betsy DeVos is gone. There was a lot of cheering. And now what we're seeing play out is a very dramatic agenda at the state level. Something like 24 states, including New Hampshire, just over the border from me, are taking advantage of the fact that Republicans made big gains during 2020, and they've got their sights set on privatizing and, I think, dismantling public education.
To what end? Improving the schools, do they imagine, or is it simply cost-cutting?
What's so interesting is that the language we're so used to about school improvement, about international competition, is really gone now. Now it's just about individual parent choice. It's about making the decision that's right for you and your individual family. None of that language about community, about democracy, about civic responsibility, that common school language that you referred to, that's all gone. It's just the language of the marketplace.
Noliwe Rooks, in your book, you've coined a new word, segronomics, the whole idea of a huge investment, and it's private as well as public, in unequal schools. Unfurl that if you can.
The idea of segronomics is really trying to figure out why we have spent so many decades, centuries, trying to figure out how to fix unequal education, unequal schools, segregated schools. We have a commitment to ending them. And yet, across the country, racial and economic segregation for Black, Latinx, poor kids means that they're going to school with people who are most like them. So the question for me became, well, who is benefiting from this? But what I've found is, much like Jennifer was talking about with this privatization, it's going on across the country. It's going on in communities large and small, legislatures across the country. It has a particular kind of devastating impact in communities with school districts that are majority of color and poor. And so Segronomics is a mashup of segregation and economics, and it's a way to hold those things in tension, to think about how one is playing off of the other in things like the reopening schools debate during COVID, in things like voting, but to not act like all schools are the same, all communities are the same, or that educational policy is impacting everyone in the same way.
One of my takeaways from your remarkable book, Nolewe, is the thought that it's not a problem of insufficient money. There's plenty of money. And in fact, schools and the privatizing of schools have become a sort of gold mine for corporate America, Silicon Valley in particular. Do I have it right?
Yeah. If you just take testing, for example, since Bush declared that we wanted to leave no child behind and that we would test all of these children, this was a civil rights issue. I mean, he actually announced this policy in front of the NAACP and got all of these Black civil rights leaders together so that he could talk about how closing the achievement gap was a civil rights issue for our time, and that testing, high stakes testing in third grade and eighth grade, was going to get it done because it's going to give us all this information that we need to close this gap. So this is just one example. No one in education would tell you that testing in and of itself closes gaps. You know, testing just tells you there are gaps. But the testing industry that has risen up all over the country, but again, this is about how it particularly impacts the most vulnerable, is this multi-billion dollar industry that mostly what it does is tell segregated communities, poor communities, Black and Latinx people, that they're not good enough, that they're not learning enough, that they're not working hard enough. Tests give you a snapshot. What are the policies that are going to teach kids, that are going to help them, that, you know, going to close this gap? And there's been precious little other than closing schools, opening charter schools, as Jennifer talked about, moving money around. None of that closes educational gaps. So you have the gaps remain, but these testing entities are gaining more and more wealth. That for me is the essence of Segronomics. It's the segregation, but there's a business model that gets to profit from that undereducation.
Linda Nathan, you're our authority in the trenches over many years, teacher, school starter, headmaster or principal, and now teaching leadership. What is the direction of what you would call reform in 2021?
I love the question, and I love being on this podcast with the two of you, and of course with Chris. So I think we need to remember, and we know this, smart is not a zip code. Smart is not a zip code. And schools cannot change poverty and housing segregation, which is why we get school segregation. And Jonathan Kozol's been writing about this apartheid for decades, is completely antithetical to what we say we want, which is, you mentioned it early, Chris, about the common school. Schools are the only place in our society still where we could ever hope to practice democracy, little d, but we have created schools to be the most rule-bound, the most compliant of institutions that you can possibly imagine. So in the years since we instituted high-stakes testing, which, as Nolewe talks about, that was a direct result of this No Child Left Behind, and it became synonymous with high-stakes testing. Listen, I started in the 70s. We knew in the 70s who was doing well and who wasn't doing well. All that high-stakes testing did was provide a finer point on it and give us more transparent data. Yeah, data is good, but do we need to be testing for literally 3 to 4 weeks a year, starting with six-year-olds? I don't think so. We need teachers who can really think about relationships and, of course, relevance. And we need teachers who can build school communities with school leaders where kids want to belong, where this is the club I want to be part of, and I love it because it's diverse.
Linda Nathan, I just got to bear witness that you do what you say. I've seen you in the corridors of
Arts Academy in Boston, and they call your mom and they'll tell you everything and you know them like a book. You're now running your own Institute for Creative Leadership in the names of Vito Perone and Ted Sizer, who inspired you. What's the short form?
We talk about words like love and revolution.
Amazing.
You know, love is the only emotion that can really change people's minds. Hmm. For leaders, you do not have to like who you work with, but you must love them. And the other thing we talk about, we use the word revolution because we so deeply believe the schools of today are absolutely broken. One of the things we all talked about when COVID hit, now is the opportunity to really reinvent. You know, the New York Times had this great article about the 1918 pandemic when city kids from New York City went out and had school on ferry boats. And I kept saying to my school principals, let's get outside. Let's actually do school outside. Who did that? The private schools and the wealthy suburbs. Not one urban school was able to pivot in the name of, quote, equity. And I'm holding up my fingers doing air quotes. And we need to rethink what schooling can look like in the name of Vito Perone and Ted Sizer, so that it is experiential, so that we are making and doing every day, and that I really believe this question of environmental justice, sustainability, and how we bring, even in our cities, the outdoors inside. And the other thing that all of us know, COVID, if it did anything, was one more time, it showed us the deep inequities in our systems, in our societies, the deep racism, the deep ways that those who were most affected were Black and brown and poor. At least what we can do is say to our children, the idea of your wellness, of your wholeness, of you as a whole human being, that's what's important to me. Yes, you've got to learn some content. Yes, you're going to learn some skills. But the trauma that you and your family have experienced is something that I, as a teacher, need help to understand how to work with. So again, smart is not a zip code. And please, this is an opportunity to reinvent schools.
We're in the American Schoolhouse as students and teachers flock back from COVID exile. Our guests are Linda Nathan, famous for the Arts Academy in the Boston Public School System. Also, Noliwe Rooks, who teaches African American studies at Cornell. And the reporter, Jennifer Berkshire, whose podcast is called Have You Heard? This is Open Source. We're supposing that Joe Biden, who has his own wonderfully mixed record, personal and political, on public education, has asked for straight talk from the pros. ACE reporter Jennifer Berkshire, Professor Noliwe Rooks from Cornell, and Linda Nathan, the ever-ready spark plug inside the Boston public school system for decades now. The president is deferring this hour to your collective history, ladies. Where are we? Where are we going? What have we got to stop doing? Or do for a change? Tell the president. You first, Linda Nathan, please.
Where are we is we see what this pandemic has done to us, President Biden. For God's sakes, moratorium on high-stakes testing. Listen to your wife. She would say that. Why are you making this something that we need to do in a year that we're returning from a pandemic? What we need is deep training in social emotional learning, in wellness. We need to understand the traumas that our kids and teachers have been through. So President Biden, for goodness sakes, you have the power to stop federal high stakes testing. Stop it. Secondly, what do I want you to do? So I want to go back to a time in our history, and I'll need Noliwe's help for this, I think. In the 60s, when we were talking about the nuclear threat and Russia and the Cold War, we actually had a huge investment in new curricula. One of the things that has been so distressing to me, because of high stakes testing, we have so flattened our curriculum. It has become writing a 5-paragraph essay. That's it. The arts are out the window. So what I want, in other words, most schools, I can guarantee you, given your zip code, you will not have an arts education. So what I want you to do, President Biden, I want you to make sure that every kid in this great country has access to deep arts making, whether it's photography, whether it's clay, whether it's theater, dance. I want it all, because artists can help us see through our pain, can envision a new world. And then I want a huge commitment in new science education. So science is not the field of the elite, but science is part of casual conversation. And I really would like to see huge investments in that. And my last thing I want from you is I want an investment in community-based teacher education. And finally, and this is really radical, and then I'll get off my soapbox, I don't want high school to be 4 years anymore. Mm-hmm. I would like high school to be completely reinvented so that young people starting in eighth grade every year get to do an internship in the community, so that by the time they get to think about college, they've already had four different internships, eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade, 11th grade. And I'd like the 12th grade year to be totally, totally reconfigured. So that's my request to you, President Biden.
Hold it there, Linda. You're not putting race balances and imbalances at the top of the list, but is it true, starting with you, Noliwe, that schools will be more segregated by race, class, and income as we resume after COVID than they ever have been before? What does it matter?
Well, here's what I'll say. I mean, according to Gary Orfield and the research that he does, yes. In urban areas, I mean, there's a caveat there. In urban areas where post-industrial cities, yes, we are looking at hugely segregated schools. And the other thing that he points out is that, you know, white students are the most segregated. Like, white students are basically going to school with white students in a lot of mm-hmm. places. The things that I would say about COVID to President Biden is that, you know, we've talked so often about how COVID has really just revealed, it hasn't created new kinds of inequalities, really. It's widened, it's revealed what's already there. And I would say, instead of coming up with experiments that are designed to bring Black, Latinx, vulnerable students to some sort of par, what we should do, what I always say, what I'm always going to think we need to do, is educate poor kids and vulnerable kids and Black kids in the same way as we do the wealthiest. This is very simple. It's not, you know, that we need all of these new interventions. Make all the classes gifted and talented classes. Make all of the teachers, the best teachers, the qualifications that we have in our highest performing schools are the qualifications that we need for the kids who are struggling. I just don't think it's that hard. We don't need a whole new teaching corps. We don't need, you know, you need to say, here's our new project. All of the schools are going to teach in the same kinds of ways. All of the school buildings that we put students in will have windows that can open. There's some deep equity work that we need to do, and none of it has to do with coming up with these pie-in-the-sky experiments about teaching poor kids and vulnerable kids in ways that we would never, ever teach in the more well-resourced schools. Let me be clear what I mean. When we were in Princeton, New Jersey, I raised my kid there. I haven't actually had a lot of experience with the school district here, but Princeton's well-resourced as well. But I did a lot of work in the Trenton Public Schools, which is about 20 miles away from Princeton and is one of the more poor and struggling. In the Princeton schools, the classrooms rarely have more than 12 kids in them. But in Trenton, they had 30, right? Equity to me looks like you're doing that the same. All of the classrooms in Princeton had a teacher aide. In Trenton, they did not. I think a lot of those things we take for granted in the well-resourced school district are more needed you know, are needed far more. You know, my kid was going to be fine. But we don't think about, we're sort of like, oh, we're only up to 25 kids in Trenton or in the struggling school. Probably we can go up to 40. You'd have hand-to-hand combat in the street in Princeton if you were talking about sticking 40, you know, first graders in a classroom. No one would ever even think of that, right? But in Trenton, it's regular. It's just, you know, de rigueur. In Princeton, it's not. What I mean is, whatever the highest performing school districts look like, I think that that's what we need to do in others. That, to me, is what equity looks like.
Jennifer Berkshire, it's Joe Biden we're addressing in this moment, and he has his own sensitivities here. A reminder, the sharpest tension in the Democratic nominating campaign was when Kamala Harris accused him of injuring her as a child by opposing busing for racial integration. Look at the numbers, including Boston, and you could conclude that the country has given up on racial integration in public schools. Is it true? And what does it matter for the future?
Well, while I have the opportunity to address Joe Biden, I would say hello and also thank you for, in the stimulus package is included something that we have not seen in this country for decades, which is direct funding to families with children. And what this does is it means that it represents a pivot away from what we've believed for so long, which is that our schools can be the thing that fixes poverty. So you can go all the way back to 1965 to when Lyndon Johnson proposed the real landmark Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And that's when you start hearing this language about schools addressing the needs of underprivileged kids. And it set the schools up for just tremendous disappointment and all the kinds of experiments that we've heard, you know, Noliwe talking about, but also the idea that Linda addresses so powerfully in her book that somehow grit and what happens within the four walls of the schools is going to be the thing that lifts kids out of poverty. And I mentioned this in the context of your question about desegregation, because those views really, you know, we really coalesced around the idea that we didn't have to do any of these other bigger things. Nobody had to give anything up. And so you see this powerful tilt in the 1970s away from court-ordered desegregation. The Supreme Court hands down this case that basically makes desegregation beyond the individual community level impossible. And then something just as important, the ability to share school funding, right? And so we end up with exactly the problems we've been hearing about today, which is where you have power and money concentrated in zip codes, as Linda was describing. Mm-hmm. And so I think that part of what we're seeing within the Biden administration is things that had been off the table for so long are now possibly going to be back on the table. I'm so thrilled to see that a more progressive redistributive agenda is with us and that this could potentially improve the lives of kids way more than a lot of the school-based measures we've been taking. The question that I need to ask Joe then is, well, what precisely is your vision for schools if it's not going to be the primary mechanism for helping kids overcome poverty? What do schools do? And that, you know, having his first school-related policy be insisting that kids who are now going back into schools take tests was not a good sign.
Interesting. But if schools are not going to fix poverty or can't, if they're not going to erase the color line, what are they supposed to do? And where does preparing them for work and a good job come in?
Our definition of what a school does and what a good school is has so dramatically narrowed in the era of high-stakes testing. And so we come to see good schools as places that raise math and English test scores. And so it, you know, it leaves us unprepared to defend this broader vision of public education and to make the kinds of changes that Linda argues so powerfully we really need to make. And so, Christopher, I would push back on this idea that the most important thing that schools do is prepare kids for work. If you go back to the Clinton era where our economy really starts to slow down. I mean, we're dealing with globalization. We're dealing with the rise of the sort of high information economy. We go all in on this idea that education is the way to learning is what's going to bring you earning, right? And so what happens then is that the losers of that equation end up feeling like it's their fault, whereas the winners who benefit from all sorts of the structural things that Noah Leeway has been talking about feel like they deserved what they got. And it sets us up for this incredibly corrosive dynamic. And I think as the Biden folks start to think about what schools should do, they're going to have to tackle that in some way, because the situation that we have right now is just unsustainable.
We're talking to Joe Biden. Imagine that the First Lady Jill Biden, Dr. Jill Biden, wanders into the room. Seriously, and not sentimentally, what is her role here? What could it be? What would you ask her to do?
Lift up teaching in the profession. Make this a profession that is well paid. Make this the most important thing people can do. Stop blaming teachers. That's why I keep holding up the teacher unions. That's all we've got right now. So stop bashing the teachers union. Come on, celebrate this as the best profession you can be in.
Let me say, both for Dr. Jill Biden and for President Biden and Vice President Harris, I would say we really are at a point where we need a conversation about what we nationally think schools are. I've lost the thread. I've lost the point. I know what I think they should be. I know what they were for me. I know what I would like to see be the point. But I mean, education and the outcomes and what it's supposed to be is tied to a larger ecosystem of an economy and global capital and disappearing jobs. So I've kind of lost the thread. And I would say to Dr. Jill Biden, as well as President Biden and Vice President Harris, help me understand your vision for the purpose of public schools at this point. Because right now, it just sort of depends on the school. We need a national conversation. I don't think since the A Nation at Risk, which was a disaster national conversation.
That was early Reagan.
1983 or 84, right? Not since Reagan, where we decided that business leaders needed to be more involved in the schoolhouse and that free market and competition, like that's really where it starts, need to be central to thinking about schools. But it was a national conversation. It was like a let's all get in here and say, what are schools? What is their purpose? Since then, I'm not clear, let me say. And so I would say this is a great opportunity to bring back, you know, or I'd like to bring back some of the John Dewey, Horace Mann's ideas about the function of schools. I would like to see civic education and democracy be central to schools. I would. But I think we need a more robust and some leadership around those very foundational questions.
No, Leeway, the matter of business leadership, starting with Reagan, it didn't work much, but it's still with us, it strikes me. And it's in sync with the upward movement of money in general, elitism all over the place, embodied in a certain way in let Mark Zuckerberg rebuild or finance at least the rebuilding of the schools of Newark, New Jersey. Why Mark Zuckerberg, you wonder. But why has that notion of business responsibility and leadership persisted after so much failure?
We are completely on the same page with that. With all of these successive administrations talking about who needs to be held accountable, it's teachers need to be held accountable, or unions need to be destroyed, or kids need to learn grit and resilience. Like, you're talking about kids who have no choice but to have grit and resilience because they are in circumstances that require it, right? But, you know, I mean, we've had generation after generation of ed policy that is ineffective at these goals of closing some of these gaps, at leaving no child behind, and that making sure all children succeed, which is just giving the titles of these, you know, past few ed policy the pithy names. And none of those, we left a lot of children behind. We left more children behind than before the No Child Left Behind was brought into place. The race to the top, you know, a whole lot of systems were completely broken. They raced to the bottom by this competition model. And kids were harmed, and every child succeeds. It's just a complete farce. Like, I mean, it's almost insulting that you would have something like that. And they're all based on failed ideas about what the most vulnerable kids need. I mean, what happens with the wealthier kids? Everybody's stressed out by testing. Everybody thinks that it's too much. Everybody is being kind of traumatized by some of this. But some kids have safety nets that others don't. And so far, I am gratified that President Biden seems to be of a mind to govern from the bottom up, to actually think about how he can make sure that the government is supporting and holding tenderly kids who need it most, the families that need it most. We haven't had that kind of view in relation to education in quite some time. So while all of these policies have been disastrous for some kids, it's been disastrous for many people, but for some kids, they've been hard. They've had test prep and they've had their ways, or people getting them extra time on tests, or, you know, there are ways that they're able to weather that storm. The kids who cannot are the ones who are most harmed by these policies that are constantly all about, like, don't leave any kids behind. And no one has pissed. We don't do impact assessments of these policies. We test, but we don't think about sort of like how with environmental policies, you know, they're kind of like, well, first we have to do some impact assessments, right? No, who does that with education? We just come up with these policies, and at least in the federal government, you know, the impact is, did it close this gap? As if that's the only thing that schools do, teach you to close a gap, teach you to take a test. Schools for some kids are so much more. Schools for some kids are everything. They're, right. They're where you get your medical care, your mental health stuff, the way you may wash your clothes. In general, these are not the kinds of kids that we are imagining when we're saying leave no kids behind. You know, we're not saying how does our educational system most benefit the most vulnerable? And I think if he governs from the bottom up in ed policy the way that he's doing with economic policy and healthcare, or attempting to, I really think we'll be better for it.
Coming up, what if every child were deemed gifted and talented? What if top-down classrooms went bottom up and indoor schools went outdoors? This is Open Source. At an open Zoom table, reopening schools with the journalist Jennifer Berkshire, also Professor Noliwe Rooks at Cornell, and the school builder Linda Nathan in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Noliwe, I have a question for you from your book. There's a thread, I think, that goes through it. I don't know what to call it. It's a little old-fashioned. It's sort of fundamentalist. It's pragmatic realist. But the authorities are fascinating, including W.E.B. Du Bois, the sainted W.E.B. Du Bois, who said in 1935, theoretically, the Negro needs neither segregated schools nor mixed schools. What he needs is education. And along comes Marva Collins, great heroic educator in Chicago. Ronald Reagan teased her about becoming his Secretary of Education, a black woman who said, once you teach children how to think, they don't need school. And in the two fascinating final chapters of your book, the testimony of a man named Dwight, who came from the South Bronx, went to Princeton, and became a teacher. Also Nora from Springfield, Massachusetts, who survived public school and ended up with Teach for America, with all sorts of impressions. The thread is back to basics. Connect those fascinating dots for us.
Yeah, I think one of the things that people have glommed onto is to ask me, really, is the whole point of equity in education still integration?
Amen. Thank you.
You know, integration worked fine some places, but I believe that at this point, I'm coming to believe that integration has benefited a minority at the expense of a majority, specifically talking about children of color. Integration policies are the reasons you have a Barack Obama, the reason you had a Dwight or Nora. Both of them were beneficiaries, they would tell you, of various forms of affirmative action policies, special programs that pick them up. Mm. But the majority of kids are not integrating, are not benefiting like that, but that is the only focus we have right now. So if you have kids who are still in segregated environments, what we're trying to do is to break that up and get them into schools where often their parents will tell you they don't feel very good about the environments that they're in. You know, things like homeschooling, Black parents are making up some of the fastest growing segments. And coming out of COVID, I'm hearing Black parents say, you know, well, at least my kid's not being bullied, or I feel pretty good about being able to know what they're learning. Or I think, you know, I might continue with this because of the hostile integrated environment they were in. I mean, segregation works fine for white people, right? Worked completely fine for them. Really. Other than the fact that they're not learning diversity just in a straight educational sense, which is really the metric we have. We have no metric for determining how you move in diverse spaces. We don't have grades or tests for do you have integrated social circles? And most of our integrated schools in high performing areas actually are using tracking to make sure that white children are still overly benefiting and everyone else is in a whole different thing. So I have not turned into a segregationist by any stretch, but I'm always having to say there is a complete grassroots movement going on right now around the country with Black and Latinx parents and some civil rights organizations that are asking, do we still want to put all of our time and energy into a magnet school that's trying to attract white children? And, you know, our kids are still not being well educated. Do we still want to bus our kids places where they're being bullied as the solution, you know, as the one, the silver bullet, as the thing? And what are the alternatives? That I have zero answer for, just zero. So I used to push back when I would get this, you know, we should just have our own schools and let's go back. Let's actually get some separate but equal and say, no, no, like all the data is clear. You can't. But what I realized in the conversations that I was having with people in church basements, schools, living rooms, what they were constantly saying is we've tried that. It's not keeping our children safe. How come you keep saying that to us? So I don't know the way through that, right? But I do know that I'm hearing it enough. In enough spaces that I think it's worth a conversation about.
I think a lot of white parents, and I myself would say, can you call a school great or even first rate if it doesn't immerse young American kids in the reality of a multiracial country and a mostly non-white world?
Most of the schools that we call great, including the ones I teach at, are not actually saying what we're privileging about what we're offering. That's not a criteria. That's a talking point. That's something that we say often. It's a multicultural world. When you start to look at how segregated we are by region, by ideology, by neighborhood, are we integrated? Really?
Lots of parts of the society are getting more so. Prep schools are getting more integrated. Ivy League schools are getting more integrated. Race, gender, even class.
Ivy League schools stay right around 5 to 6%, and where they've been since the 1980s. For underrepresented minorities, let me say, there are kids who are coming from other countries that count as diversifying. Mm-hmm. They can often pay full freight when they're coming. But when you seriously do a deep dive into the numbers in Ivy League schools for Black, Latinx, and Native Indigenous kids, those numbers haven't changed since the 1980s.
I tend to agree that our schools are more segregated today than ever. I think it has everything to do with housing integration or the lack thereof, the way schools are funded, which is criminal. But I do want to just mention that kids who have been exposed to diversity tend to appreciate it.
Yeah, I think that successful education is always about visionary leadership. Whatever school it is, there is creative, visionary, respectful, inclusive leadership at the core. We saw this with COVID, which we were talking about some of the schools. You know, everybody was saying, oh, Black parents don't want to send their kids back to school because we want them to be safe. Black parents that had principals that included them in decision-making, that kept them involved, that had town hall and community Zoom meetings, that really made clear what was happening around opening, people sent their kids back there willingly, skipping into the building. Yeah. We know it to be true that integrated schools with visionary leadership benefit everyone, that's not what we're faced with too frequently. Mm-hmm. There's generational impacts for sort of saying we're going to integrate without taking into account what that experience is like when it's absent. Mm-hmm. Those values. So I have no, yeah, absolutely. There's a reason that so many of our large urban area school districts look like they do. And that's not because people are resisting the kind of educational vision you're putting forward. It's because it's almost impossible for them to find that.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, their kids still got to be educated.
I agree.
Joe Biden has a question. He's getting tired of the whole discussion. And he's in a down moment, and he says to all three of you, really, with all due respect, can a country and culture as divided as ours is said to be, can it sustain open public schools as the rule, basic training for America, social inclusion, and a shared modern prosperity? He's asking all of us, do we still believe the underlying idea of public education?
I think if Biden asked that question, a tear would run down my cheek. Like, that would indicate to me that we're in even deeper trouble than I thought. That if somebody who is elected president of the United States and seemingly deeply knowledgeable about its history doesn't understand how core the institution of public education is to our democracy and how it was set up that way, that to me indicates that we're really in for it. I want him and Dr. Jill Biden to use their bully pulpits to really make that case. We've gotten so used to talking about education in the language of the marketplace. We talk about choosing education options the way we select shoes or pharmaceuticals, but the fact is that they're not the same, and it's degrading to the institution to use that language to talk about it. He needs to help us find another way to talk about schools and what they do besides competition in the language of the marketplace. And I think we're at a moment where there's a real hunger out there for that alternative, but we need somebody to help us see that.
He can talk about with Dr. Biden how schools are the place where you can think about ideas, where you can travel for free with library books, where you can see things and meet people and learn about things that you've never thought about before. And, you know, that's the awe-inspiring play that you can do when you go to school with amazing teachers. And I think he's prepared to do that.
Noliwe, I'd like you to find a forward vision in those two remarkable people, Dwight and Nora, that almost steal the show in your book. Dwight from the South Bronx went to Lawrenceville School, then Princeton, became a teacher. What's his remedy? Cap classes at 12 kids, and then build more schools. See what happens when you actually have enough teachers. Very, very basic. Nora, similarly, from Springfield, then Hartford, found her way through a gifted and talented class into teaching. She's hell-bent on cultural education for Black kids and white kids equally. Is there a vision there? In those two case histories?
Absolutely. I think for both Black people who came out of struggling school districts who themselves experienced a particular path, really wanted to go back into those classrooms and offer students that they saw like themselves help and encouragement that they didn't believe they really ever got. Until they were tapped by these particular programs that helped them. So middle school. And they both were attracted to Teach for America because it got them back in those classrooms faster. The thing about Teach for America that I have a critique about, which is that you can learn to be a teacher in 5 weeks, for both of them, they became disillusioned with that model.
Linda Nathan, both Dwight and Nora sort of hit a wall in Teach for America. You hate to think of them leaving education. Are they ready to start schools? Seriously.
Well, I think it takes 6, 7, 8 years before you know anything about teaching. It takes about 3 to 7 years, actually, to start a school. I'm working on developing 2 new schools right now.
Wow.
Outdoor-based, very experiential, and with arts at the center.
Experiential meaning?
really making and doing things so that if, you know, kids that know how to build a computer or build a house or build a car, build anything, are in much better shape than other kids, I think. And I'm really interested in kids that can build a website, kids that can build a public park, kids that can file legislation. That's to me what experiential education is about. I also have this feeling that I've said for decades now, if kids were given the opportunity to read 30 books a year, life would be different. And I really sit on the number 30. Just like the way schools have been places where we've been giving out food, some schools, Orchard Gardens has done an amazing job in Boston of also giving out books. And I would really like to see us think about a way to feed our children with real food, real healthcare, and real books.
Could I ask you all, finally, what is the price of the high technology school that we take for granted now? The price in experience, in reading books, in anything, and the price even that schools are paying for these services.
You know, everyone talks about, oh, now we know we can do school online. I think now we know we don't have to have snow days because we can do Zoom school. But I don't think technology, great as it is a substitute for a deep sense of belonging and engagement and relationships between kids and kids and kids and teachers. I know some kids have been more comfortable, but the real world is a place where getting along with people who are different than you, I still think is critical. I don't think technology can replace the importance of relationships and of good teaching and good teachers.
Nolewe Rooks, what's the place of technology in your ideal school?
So here's my struggle. On the one hand, there was an article in the New York Times that was talking about how all of these folks in Silicon Valley, like, you know, are putting this premium on raising their children to have limited interaction with technology and valuing much of what Linda's mentioning, you know, having play, exploration, imagination, reading. But what I struggle with is I'm reading things like in the 2016-17 school year, none of the buildings in the Detroit public school system were considered safe for habitation. Oh. I'm reading stories of children who are sitting in classes where it's raining on their head, where they're being sent to the hospital because of the mold spores. So I have a disconnect. Like, I want to fix that.
Infrastructure.
Right? Like, there's an idea underneath that's not just we don't have the money for schools. You're okay with putting children in spaces that your Department of Health has said should not be inhabited, right? There's things that I need to fix before we get to what is the place of technology, like really deeply at a soul level. And at this school in Detroit, they don't have any technology. Before we even get to pedagogy, how we treat our most vulnerable, the poor kids, as if they don't matter and it doesn't matter. And so I'm not a fan of technology in school. Again, I completely support the vision that Linda has of letting children be children, exploration. It's what's best. We know that it's best. But there's still such a big disconnect in this country, and I need us to focus on it.
Jennifer Berkshire, you're the journalist. Where's the light at the end of this hour? Where's the argument going?
Can I talk about the technology piece?
Sure.
A real revelation to me was to see just how far back the push to move school online really goes. It's so attractive to people for so many reasons. If you want to cut costs, or you don't like unions, right? Or if you don't want to have to pay for brick and mortar schools, that's the place where you want to go. But then because of the pandemic, we all got to see what it looked like. And, you know, people's reaction overwhelmingly was that, you know, even if there were small things about it that they preferred, for the most part, it was a vision that they saw as pretty dystopian, right? You know, schooling is about relationships, as Linda's talked about so eloquently. And so I think it does kind of present us with this very interesting conundrum, which is that one of the vehicles for making school cheaper and making teachers harder to organize turns out to be really unappealing. I worry that the bipartisan glue that has held our commitment to public education together for so long is its serious threat of unraveling. That you're starting to hear Republican lawmakers at the state level wage war against K-12 the way that they've been doing with public higher ed, and using the argument about indoctrination, whether it's about things like Black Lives Matter or sex education, the idea that you send your kids to school and they come out Democrats, they're using that to make the case for weakening the commitment to public schools and also to weaken the case for funding them. This is something new in our country, and I worry about where that's going to lead.
Jennifer Berkshire, Noliwe Rooks, Linda Nathan, cannot thank you enough. First, for your experience in this incredibly central enterprise of education, but for this conversation, thank you.
Thank you.
Jennifer Berkshire's new book is called A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door. Noliwe Rooks is the author of Cutting School. Linda Nathan's tell-all is When Grit Isn't Enough. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from Chris Johnson and Michael Garth. Mary McGrath is our Board of Education. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.